It's a great pleasure to be here and to be part of this really exciting series. I've noticed that some of the last talks have been, I think Andrew was looking at divine hiddenness, why does God hide, last week, and we've had John Thompson looking at value and humanism and human dignity and so on. Tonight, I'm going to do something a little bit different, and I'll explain why it's different, and I'll try to sort of position what I'm trying to do in relation to what Andrew and John have done. The title may have been a little misleading for some of you, or there might be some people here under a misapprehension that I'm going to talk about the history of facial hair in philosophy, a sort of hipster history of philosophy. And I was panicking, this is an irrational fear, but I was panicking about this last night, right? Because some of the invites went out without the crucial expanding sentence after Plato's beard and Occam's razor. So I discovered a very useful history of facial hair in philosophy. It sounds a little bit crazy, but if anyone is here under a misapprehension, this little bit is for you. Turns out that beards really mattered to the ancient Greeks, to the Romans, to the Franciscans. How you wore your beard as a philosopher signified what kind of a philosopher you were. If, for example, you were a cynic, that's not a small c, cynic with a capital C, it was a branch of philosophers who refused to have anything to do with civilized society. They were skeptical about everything. And they wore their beards very, very long and bedraggled and dirty. And that was reflective of their philosophical outlook. We tend to think now, unfortunately, of philosophy as a very narrow academic discipline that's conducted in seminars or lectures. But of course, in the ancient world, philosophy was a way of life. You followed a philosopher. You were one of the Stoa, you were a Stoic, or you were an Epicurean, you followed Epicurus, or you were a Platonist, or you were an Aristotelian, and so on and so on. It's much more like what we would think of as a religion. And so what you wore, the kinds of things you did, and how you wore your beard, or whether you had a beard at all, mattered a great deal. So this irrational fear actually developed into a very interesting evening yesterday. I then realized that so Plato, we know, had a beard, wasn't too long, it was quite well kept, it was aristocratic and so on. Aristotle, a little bit more careful, I think. Everything changed with Alexander the Great, who apparently banned his men from having beards because the worry was that the enemy would grab them. So clean-shaven, and Alexander the Great was a great image setter. And so it's a very interesting history. I have a Greek Orthodox priest who I saw this afternoon, and I just realized I've never seen a Greek Orthodox priest who doesn't have a beard. And he told me that this is very important, that Greek Orthodox priests have beards in conscious continuity with the Greek philosophical tradition that came before Christianity. After the split between Orthodoxy and Catholicism, Catholics, priests were banned from having beards, and actually, turns out Catholic priests, monks, don't have beards. Anyway, I'm not going to... There's a little bit for anyone who's come here under a misapprehension. But Plato's beard and Occam's razor are intended to be metaphors. What kind of metaphors might they be for? What do we mean by this? Well, I want to backtrack a little bit and just think about what it is that philosophers do. Is there progress in philosophy? Have philosophers, well, they've had 2,500 years pretty much. Let's assume philosophy begins with Plato. How are they doing on the free will problem? Are we free or are we determined? How are they doing on whether time is real? They're still talking about it, I can tell you. That's just a burning issue. How are they doing on what good and evil is, or whether there's such a thing at all? How are they doing on the question of the existence of God? Well, I got to say, hasn't been much progress in the sense that we might think of science as progressing. Actually, this is often quoted, perhaps too much, but it's still, there's a real kernel of truth to it. Alfred North Whitehead in 1929 famously said that the safest general characterization of Western philosophy is that it consists in a series of footnotes to Plato. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but there's a lot of truth to it. If you read some of those short dialogues, you realize that these questions are still being rehearsed and debated and puzzled over today. So philosophy is not like science. It's not like mathematics either. So what is it? What's going on? What's the point of it? Philosophers generally have said that there are two ways that we can arrive at philosophical truth and defend philosophical truth. The first method, and this is a kind of reasoning, the first method is the deductive, so-called deductive method. And the idea behind the deductive method is simply that you can get from the premises of an argument to a conclusion by sitting in your armchair. You don't need to get up. The conclusion will just follow. Once you've grasped the premises, the conclusion will follow. Here's a deductive argument. X equals 2, Y equals 3, X plus Y equals 5. You don't need to get up. You don't need to inspect the world to work out the truth. It's just internally true. That's a deductive argument. Just if the premises are true, the conclusion follows. The other kind of reasoning is inductive reasoning. And this is the reasoning of the natural sciences. So here you've got to get up out of your armchair. You have to go and inspect the world. You've got to gather evidence. Gather evidence. But you're never going to get to an absolutely watertight conclusion. Now, there was a time when we thought all, to use the common example, we thought all swans were white. And that was a sort of inductive conclusion. Till Captain Cook discovers Australia and realizes it's actually there are a few black swans too. Right. So experience, checking the world, altered the conclusions. We needed to refine the conclusions. And you're never going to get to certainty there, but that's the method of the natural sciences. Inspecting the world, getting up out of the armchair. The armchair is really the realm of the mathematician, the pure reasoner. Mathematics, science. When it comes to the question, philosophical questions, there's a debate as to which form of reasoning we can use and should be used to reach a particular conclusion. And this is especially true in the ancient debate about whether or not God exists. You have these many, many different arguments for God's existence, fewer against, but there are some strong ones. Probably one of the most well-known would be the ontological argument, thought up by St. Anselm in prayer and written down as a prayer to God. It's an argument that is deductive in its form. Anselm didn't need to leave his cloister. Why? Because he said that you could get to the existence of God just from thinking really hard about the concept of God. What God is. God is a maximally perfect being. If such a being is even possible, it's necessary. That's not quite his formulation, but that's a sort of contemporary formulation. Whether you like that argument or not, and it's still stimulating a great deal of sophisticated debate today, it's a deductive argument. You sit in the armchair and you can have it out. Other kinds of arguments, a cosmological argument or the design argument, these arguments are to do with certain features of the natural world. The Big Bang, for example, scientific evidence for the Big Bang, or scientific evidence for the life-permitting conditions of the universe. These are, we talk to the scientists, the sciences are involved. These are inductive arguments. What I'm going to do this evening is to suggest a third option. And this is known as abduction, or sometimes inference to the best explanation. And the idea here is that the existence of God is not an empirical hypothesis. It's not, God is not something you can just put under a microscope. It's not, God is not, if he exists at all, he's not something who, he's not a being who we can kind of detect empirically. Abduction suggests that what you want to try to do is develop an overall theory, an overarching kind of hypothesis that sheds light on what you are investigating and which satisfies certain criteria. This is something which I am borrowing from secular philosophy, a particularly contemporary secular philosophy. One of the deepest anxieties that secular philosophers have here in Cambridge and in Oxford, all over the English-speaking world, is how you can be a naturalist, by which I do not mean how can you just take off all your clothes and run around the streets of Cambridge and Oxford and just enjoy nature. How can you be a metaphysical naturalist? How can you hold fast to the claim that science is the ultimate arbiter of all that there ever was, all that there is, and all that there ever will be? Nature is a closed system, and there can be no appeal to non-natural things in the world. Right? Think of reality like a shopping list. And you can have all sorts of things on that shopping list, but they have to be, in principle, detectable through the natural sciences. That's naturalism. And that is the dominant orthodoxy in philosophy faculties throughout the English-speaking world. It's not to be confused, by the way, with methodological naturalism. If you're a theist, you ought to be a methodological naturalist. Methodological naturalism is simply the very same idea that when we're doing science, we don't invoke non-natural entities. We don't talk about the fairies might have done this. We don't invoke non-natural entities. Metaphysical naturalism is great. Metaphysical naturalism actually is a gift of Christianity to the world. What do I mean by that? Prior to the revolution that Christianity brought about in philosophical thought, beginning in the second century and then spreading deeply into the west and eastern parts of Europe and beyond in the 1500 years or so following that, was at the heart of it was the doctrine of creation from nothing by a single being who was morally perfect and supremely powerful and supremely rational. That simple idea secularizes the natural world. What do I mean by that? It naturalizes the natural world. Well, if you think about it, prior to this revolution in thought, Greco-Roman kind of popular philosophizing was very comfortable with explaining odd features of the natural world by invoking non-natural beings. Poseidon was the god of the earthquake, the god of the sea. The satyrs, the nymphs in the woods, it was a world crowded with the supernatural. The doctrine of creation, monotheism, evacuates the natural world of, evacuates, as it were, the scientific method, such as it was then, of any appeal to these non-natural entities. Christianity, in other words, kind of creates nature, as this fully kind of secular and intelligible object of human inquiry and scientific inquiry. So I'm not talking here about methodological naturalism. We're talking about metaphysical naturalism. This is the view. This view is not about how we do the natural sciences. It's simply the claim that there are no non-natural entities, specifically no God. Why is this such a problem, this prevailing orthodoxy? Problem for them. Why is this a worry? Well, because it turns out that it's not just God who is an objectionable non-natural entity. It's not just God that doesn't fit on the shopping list. It's a whole load of other features of human experience. Hugh Price, who's the top professor of philosophy here, has written very well about this. He's a convinced and highly sophisticated atheist, and he says this is the problem of the M words. We have a problem of the M words. This is a paper he wrote about 2 years ago. This is about as live as it gets. The problem of the M words, these are kinds of thing that features of human experience of the world that naturalism has a really tough time accommodating. M word number one, the moral. Moral reality. The good, the right, the wrong, the bad. These are not entities that are obviously reducible to just tables and chairs and atoms and matters. There does seem to be a kind of explanatory loss if you can give a satisfactory account of how these moral properties are, as it were, can be eliminated completely in favor of the material. Because the moral life is something that's intuitively cuts very deep within us. Something that we have powerful intuitions about. There's something within us that really wants to say to Friedrich Nietzsche that he's got it wrong. Really is a moral domain that is independent of our subjective preferences and attitudes and conventions and social etiquette and so on. And that's M word number one. Much more to be said about that. M word number two, the mental. The old-fashioned word for this was the soul. But today we talk about the mind, just the mind. The mind is so puzzling for naturalism. They call this mental properties. This is the jargon, mental properties. Consciousness. It's a very difficult thing to explain in terms of just physical properties. There's a famous philosopher called Frank Jackson who comes up with a thought experiment. You might call it the thought experiment. There's something about Mary. This is the experiment. And he asks us to imagine a brilliant scientist called Mary, born and brought up in a laboratory that is black and white, colorless, black, white, gray. But she is a brilliant neuroscientist. She is so brilliant that there comes a point where she knows everything there is to know about what's going on in the human mind, the perceptual faculties, everything there is to know about what happens to us when we see the color red. Everything. She has got everything science could ever find, ever know about the neurological processes that are occurring when a human being sees the color red. And one happy day, the door to the lab is opened, and she walks out, and someone gives her a rose. Does Mary learn something new? Does Mary learn something she didn't know before? Or does she undergo an experience that she simply that is a kind of a new layer to her experience of the world. Now, Jackson says that, you know, we have very strong intuitions that yes, she does. Yes, there is something that Mary learns when she steps out of the lab and receives the rose. It's a conscious experience that no matter how much she knows, no matter how complete the printout of third-person knowledge about what's going on in the head, woman, you see the color red, she still doesn't know what it's like to see red. Naturalism really struggles to give a good account of what's going on there. Why? Because the thought experiment says everything that we know about nature, everything that's going on in the natural realm, when the color red is being perceived, is in. All the facts are in. We grant the naturalist all there is to know. But it still seems that it's falling short of it, that it would, that wouldn't capture for Mary actually seeing the red of the rose, the redness of the rose. That's M word number two. We've had the moral, we've had the mental. The third M word is the modal. This is you're unlikely to have come across this unless you've done a little bit of philosophy before. But the modal truths for philosophers are really those truths that are to do with possibility, necessity, impossibility, contingency. Why would philosophers be worried about this? Or why would naturalists be worried about this? Well, modal truths are pretty puzzling. Naturalists, they tend to be empiricists, that is to say, what you see is what you get. Sense experience before you, that's what you see. Necessity, I don't know, the necessity of the number two, if the number two exists, or possibility, these make naturalists uneasy. These seem to be, at least it makes them uneasy to the extent that we have an intuition that what's possible and what's necessary is really hardwired into the way the world is and is not just us, you know, projecting what we think is necessary and what we think is possible. It's M word number three. M word number four, the mathematical. The mathematical. Why is this a problem? Well, I mentioned earlier that classic example of a deductive argument, just a sitting in the armchair argument, is just a mathematical equation. We don't need to know anything about the way. It just seems to come to us, just like that. No microscope needed, no research reports required. It's just there. And there's a very powerful intuition that when someone like Andrew Wiles is cracking Fermat's Last Theorem, and if you haven't seen, I think you can still get on YouTube the Horizon documentary of this brilliant man, Andrew Wiles, who's lived here for many years, went to school here, he's now in Oxford. He cracked this ancient problem called Fermat's Last Theorem. It's an amazing breakthrough, amazing feat of human ingenuity. And there's a very strong intuition that what Wiles did was not construct a really, really devilishly clever mathematical theory. It's that he discovered something. He got it. He did a big paper here in Cambridge in 1992-93, I think, and it turned out actually that he'd got something wrong and there was a crisis. It's a wonderful story. There's a book on it by Simon Singh, and he got it wrong, and so he had to go back to the drawing board. But the following year, he fixed it, and he did it. And when you see him being interviewed about this, he said, when he gets to the point where he discovered it, he breaks down, just said it was just so beautiful. So beautiful. More about that later. Beauty and truth. But my point here is simply that he seems to have discovered something about the world. But obviously, not the natural world. He locked himself away in his study for 7 years with a few very boring books and a blackboard. But he discovered something about reality that that can't obviously make it onto the naturalist's shopping list of reality. And we don't need to get complicated. Let's just say the number two. This really strong intuition that the more science we do, the more mathematical it gets, the more intimately aligned this spooky world of mathematics that's got nothing to do with the concrete, nothing to do with the physical, the more intimately intertwined it seems to be with the concrete and the physical. That is troubling. Deeply troubling if you think that all there ever was, all that there ever is, all that there ever will be, is the natural. And particularly if you're brandishing science as the be-all and end-all, because science is, as I said, getting more mathematical, not less. Okay, we're on four M words now, aren't we? We've had the moral, we've had the mental, we've had the modal, we've had the mathematical. The meaningful. This is a slightly tricky one, but this is to do with how our thoughts, how the brain, thoughts in the brain, little firings in our gray matter, could hook on to the world. How a thought could be about Napoleon. That aboutness relation, or how a thought could be about unicorns, a chunk of a cluster of brain cells could be about something. That's, for the naturalist, very odd. Why? Well, with naturalism, you can traffic in causal relations, right? You can talk about billiard balls, and they do to for a lot, you know, good old cause and effect. That's okay. But aboutness or inference, right? I said earlier, what did we say earlier? If x equals 2, y equals 3, then x plus y is 5. It's 5. And what are we doing there? We're inferring. But it's not that those three lines are causing anything. It's not like that's the wrong way to think about it. They're conceptual connections. They're not causal connections. Maybe there is an underlying causal structure that's going on. If the brain stops working, you're not going to be able to follow that through. So people who reject naturalism don't need to reject that there's some sort of causal underpinning to it. It's just that it's not all that it all can't be all that it is. These logical connections are not causal connections. And it's a category mistake to think that they are. This is the worry. Couple more. The musical. This is a bit of a cheat, but I don't think Hugh Price actually talks about the musical, but here's another one. The musical. And let the musical stand for just aesthetic, the aesthetic dimension to life. Beauty. Visual beauty, oral beauty, sensory beauty, all kinds of... beauty is... Yes, of course, it does seem to be a sort of subjective element to aesthetic judgment, but on the whole, I think there is a sense that aesthetic properties, that beauty commands our attention. Might be people who think Mozart was tone deaf, but I think what you want to think about those people is there's some sort of deficiency there. You know, it's just not, you want to help them. Or someone, you sort of walk blindfold to the center of the Sistine Chapel and you take the blindfold off and they say, oh my goodness, can we go for a coffee? I don't doubt that, you know, there may well be doubtless people like that, certainly more than there used to be. But there's a strong intuition there that no, they've not grasped something here. That there's some kind of defect. But how do we explain this in purely natural terms? I don't doubt that some sort of evolutionary just so story could well be given, involving peacocks and all sorts of things. I mean, that's not what's at issue here. The issue is it the case that the evolutionary process has got us? How is it the case that the evolutionary process has got us through, say, accepting as true this just so story, to the point where we as natural creatures can perceive something that seems to be irreducible to any configuration of natural properties? Final M word, let's just go for this one, metaphysics. Metaphysics. This is a tricky one. I was reading an essay by C.S. Lewis on the history of the word metaphysics, and it gets a bad rep, but Aristotle, the great philosopher Aristotle, wrote a book called The Metaphysics. He didn't call it The Metaphysics, but when his works were being collected in the library, the great library in Alexandria in the 3rd century BC, the librarians looked at this book and they just didn't know what to make of it. It came after Ta Physica, it came after the natural things, the physics, but it wasn't really physics. And yet it was sort of about physics. So they said, well, we'll put this after the physics, metataphysica. Metaphysics, metataphysica. Now, as it happens, rather fortunately, we sometimes talk of meta in terms of going up a level, you know, being ironic and meta and so on. So it's actually kind of happily converged. Because what metaphysics is it's really looking into, really what I've been talking about for the last few minutes, it's looking at the deepest constituents of reality. It's thinking about ultimate reality, the deepest kind of why questions. Even if you reject that there are such questions, you reject that they're intelligible, that in itself is a metaphysical position. Why? Because it's not a position you can confirm or deny through doing physics. It's just not, are we free, are we not? Well, just be patient. Look, my atheist friends say, look, just be patient. Look at how science has progressed over the last 200-300 years. Just give us more time. I call this a godlessness of the gaps. Some natural theologians have said, oh, yes, it's just God of the gaps. And the God of the gaps idea is, well, the thing about you theists is, There's something we can't explain yet, and you just wheel God in. And that's just, you know. And then one day, that's a hostage to fortune, because one day we're going to work out what that is, and then where are you going to be then? Ha! That, by the way, is a legitimate criticism. It has been a legitimate criticism with respect to some natural theologians, but on the whole, I think it's not a fair one. It is fair, though, I think, that there is a godlessness of the gaps, that what I call a promissory note naturalism. And here the thought is, well, this free will problem, or this existence of God problem, or whether the number two exists problem, or whether how thoughts hook onto the world. Just, okay, it's a gap, but look how far we've got without God. Look how far we've got just through science. Just give us another 300 years. We'll get there. We'll solve consciousness. We'll solve what morality is really all about. We'll solve whether or not the number two exists. Now, I think hopefully from what I've been saying up until now that just gets it completely wrong. Because the claim is precisely that these are not features of the human experience or reality that can be grasped or investigated through the natural sciences. Remember Mary in the, you know, she's got all of science, all that there ever will be. And the intuition is when she leaves She sees the rose. She learns. She sees something new. Something new. She undergoes a perceptual experience that she didn't have. So that's metaphysics. And metaphysics, if you like, is a kind of the umbrella term to describe the sorts of things I've been talking about up until now. But there are some specific problems in metaphysics which the naturalist has real difficulties with. I don't want to go on too much about this because it gets a little bit technical. But one of the problems that's dominated Western philosophy since Plato and Aristotle is the so-called problem of universals. Does that ring any bells here? The basic worry here is blue chair, there's a blue chair here, there's a blue chair there, there's a blue chair there. It's the blue things all around here. And we want to be able to say that there is something in virtue of which all of these things are blue. Plato says, well, look, there's this form, blueness. He didn't actually say this. It's an example. There's this form, courage. It's the form, four-legged, which courageous things and four-legged things kind of exemplify or instantiate. Now, I know that sounds a little bit odd. But here's the alternative. The alternative is there is nothing in virtue of which courageous things, no single thing in virtue of which courageous things are courageous, four-legged things are four-legged, blue chairs are blue. What's going on here, the naturalist tends to say, is that we are projecting things onto the world, linguistic schemes, conceptual schemes, and it's us doing the organizing. Right? We're doing all that. This is sometimes known as nominalism. There are nomina, there are names for things, and that's enough to do all the work that the Platonic heaven was supposed to do. Now, there are all sorts of problems with that. I think most obviously, there's a powerful intuition that if something dreadful happened to the planet tonight, and all language users and all concept possessors disappeared, there's a powerful intuition that the blue chairs would still be blue. They would still be the way they are. Four-legged things would still be four-legged. There'd be no more courageous people left. Fine. Do you see the worry? So the Platonic heaven, obviously the naturalists hate, because that's just by definition everything that's kind of out there. So, okay, where is all this going? What I've been saying up until now, the M words, those seven or eight M words, distill a real problem for naturalism. The temptation is for the naturalist to become a non-naturalist. But not a theist, heaven forbid. Maybe a Platonist. So you've got this unthreatening Platonic heaven, and maybe that could do all the work. That could make things blue. That could make good things good. That could explain possibility and necessity and the aesthetic. That's where beauty sits, as it were. This is growing Plato's beard, right? What do you do when you've got an explanatorily inadequate theory? Well, you just plug more things into the theory until you get the explanations you want. Okay, worried about mathematics? Have some numbers. Have infinite numbers of them. Well, you have to have, if you grant the existence of number two, you grant the existence of all other numbers. It'd be very odd if it's just selective Platonic heaven. So yeah, you have all of them. Have all of them. Grow Plato's beard very, very long. Theories get more and more complex for each category of thing, the modal, the moral, the mental, the meaningful, mathematical, and so on. Getting a big, very big beard. And this is going to lead to what the worry is, a bloated ontology, a big, big theory that includes lots and lots of posits, lots and lots of theoretical ingredients. And the naturalist just goes, no, we can't do this. We've got to shave. We've got to shave these things away, says Occam's razor. He never said it, but the Latin tag that was applied to him was entia non sint multiplicanda praeter necessitatem. It's a very grand way of saying, don't add more, posit more things than you need. Keep your theories lean and mean. Keep them simple. Keep them elegant. As I said, the naturalist would love to do that. But then, if you shave too much, got rid of the beard, you're back where you started. So what does the naturalist do? What does the non-naturalist do? He's grown Plato's beard, but then it's so bloated. And what's going to happen? What can we do? What I want to suggest is that there's an abductive account to be given within a theological framework. Peter Lipton, who was a great professor of science here, sadly died, wrote the best book on abduction. He said, when we're doing science, it's a hallmark of the probability of the truth of a hypothesis that it displays loveliness. That's an odd word for a professor of the history and philosophy of science in Cambridge to use. We're looking for the loveliness of a theory, its elegance, its compactness, what the medieval theologians call its convenientia, its fittingness. Medievals were very comfortable with this idea because truth and beauty were thought to be the same thing. Existing in God is the same thing. They were supposedly convertible. We see them as different, but they're actually together, united. So how do you shave with Occam's razor? What are we talking about here? Well, there are different ways to shave with Occam's razor. One of them is to say, well, what you want to shave away is, what you want to be looking for when you're shaving are those parts of Plato's beard where you're multiplying, just multiplying entities. You just want to get rid of those. Another way of shaving with Occam's razor is to say you want to get rid of kinds of entities. So look, once you've got one of a thing, say the universe, you can have loads of you. You can have your multiverse hypothesis. You can have millions of universes. The idea is that, look, we've got one of them. You know, have as many as you like. It's not objectionable. Now, there's been some resistance to that, but I think we can grant the naturalist that. The real problem is what's called qualitative economy. And this is where you're introducing into your theory, you're trying to increase the explanatory power of your theory by bringing in a completely new thing. What might that be? Well, a Platonic heaven. This strange realm of abstract objects, numbers. There's no cause and effect. They exist necessarily. There's no space. There's no time. It's no place. It's a really weird kind of thing. If there was any way we could come up with a philosophical account of the M words that didn't invoke that very, very strange addition to our shopping list of reality, that's going to be a great theory. That's going to help us on the economy and on the parsimony. That's Occam's razor. I think if Occam were around today, he'd have had a laser. Occam's laser is slightly different. Occam's laser says something more like, well, don't worry about all the stuff that you're adding to your theory. Just look at what's at the bottom, like the main, philosophers call the primitive. You know, what's right at the bottom of the theory that does most of the explaining higher up? Okay, so one of the really crazy ways that naturalists try and get round the mathematical problem is this. Wait for it. This is, right, they don't want a platonic heaven of numbers. This is what they do. They say, there's this thing called an empty set, a set of no members, just an empty set. That's the number one, the one set, the empty set. The number two is the set that contains only the empty set. It's two, got two things, and so on. So you see how they're just building up. Okay, it's mad, right? But this is, they think, a way around positing, introducing a huge platonic heaven. Right? And the thought is, it's great for Occam's razor, because at the bottom of your whole theory of numbers, you've got something very, very, just an empty set. What could be more economical than that? And if the idea is, if you've got a very nice lean and mean primitive, nice lean and mean foundation, all the rest can be added unto you. And you have the same distinction on Occam's razor. You could say, well, ideally you don't want to multiply kinds of theoretical primitives, or you might not want to multiply lots and lots of different primitives. Final criterion for loveliness. There are others, but let's just try and keep it. No idea of the time, David. Keep, yeah. 5 minutes, okay. It's called the principle of nihil ad hoc. You might have heard the phrase ad hoc. Oh, that's very ad hoc. What does that mean? It just means, oh, you just kind of brought that in from nowhere to win the argument. My wife does this all the time. Where did that come from? That's so ad hoc. I go all philosopher. How about that? A bit of Latin. Whoosh. Ad hoc. It's a serious principle when you're doing the sciences. All of these criteria, by the way, are borrowed from the scientific method. Right? So these are not mine. I'm simply taking from the opponents, the enemy. Just the sciences are not the enemy. Let's look at the criteria that are universally endorsed. It's not part of the God debate. Just these are the criteria. I didn't make them up. The thought is, when you're trying to come up with a scientific hypothesis or a philosophical hypothesis, and you start to get into trouble, don't just introduce a neat little theoretical element, ex machina, that's just going to solve, that's going to help you get to the conclusion. It's not that that's necessarily going to be a false conclusion, just as it might be the case that theories are not that simple. I mean, these are not kind of... The thing about abduction is it's not certainty. It's not like our deductive armchair reasoning. It's a question of fit. We can't get to an absolute deductive conclusion. So we've got all these hypotheses. They roughly explain the same sorts of things. So how are we going to decide between them? Well, we look for loveliness. We see how well they satisfy these different criteria. So we want something that's not ad hoc. We want something, a thesis that's not just kind of brought in from nowhere. Okay, to close, why is theism an attractive, a lovely hypothesis? There are all sorts of arguments, which I am not going to go into now because we would be here all night. But so you're going to just have to trust me, and if you're interested in them, email me or talk to me afterwards. There are fascinating new developments in philosophy of religion that are coming up with highly sophisticated accounts of how God can explain the moral. Most famously, perhaps, that's been a debate that's been a case that's been advanced for many years, really since Plato. The moral, the mental, the modal, the mathematical, the meaningful, the musical, metaphysical. For all of those, theistic philosophers have advanced God as an explanation. I'm sorry I can't go into more detail than that, but just have to, as I said, take it from me that they are ongoing and extremely interesting debates. And the tide goes up and down. Sometimes it seems like the theists have the upper hand. on some of them. Sometimes it looks like the atheist. You know, so it's just that's philosophy. There's no kind of progress. There's never going to be. We're never going to discover the kind of the Higgs boson here. So it's, you know, it's the nature of it. But so these are very reasonable, sophisticated, and powerful explanations according to some sophisticated philosophers. I'm afraid that's all I can say for now. The thought is that if that's the case, then how does it measure up in terms of loveliness? Occam's razor. One being with a few mental powers, some causal powers. No Platonic heaven, no objectionably mysterious world of abstracta. A minded person with mental and causal powers. That's it. That's it. It's not a, of course, God is a mysterious being, but it's not objectionably mysterious. He's a person, immaterial, minded, causal powers. We can get a grip on it. We can get a grip on it. We may reject it. We may not like it, but we can form an idea of it. We can get a grip of that kind of a being. And it's not a new layer of reality. It's not some new qualitatively distinct category of existent. And it's one, just one. God is one. On the laser, we're not adding God into the middle of the theory here. It's right. Doctrine of creatio ex nihilo begins God. That's fundamental to the theory. If it's a theological theory at all, what would be more foundational than God? If God is already on the books, if God is already part of the metaphysical picture, what's going to be more fundamental than that? What else are you going to appeal to if you're within that framework? Ad hoc, nihil ad hoc. Is this something that's just been brought in just to kind of plug the gaps? Whatever you think about Christianity, it did not begin as an exercise in trying to shore up shaky secular solutions to philosophical problems. You read the Church Fathers, you know, it is, Augustine engages with it briefly, Aquinas, it's not that they're ignorant of the philosophical richness of classical theism, but that's not what's going on here. This is not a sort of philosophical school that is invented and developed and to deal with these. This just happens, as it were, by the by. So most religious people, most churchgoers, just don't think about these things, and thank God for that. Right? It is what it is. Has been what it has been for the last 2 and a bit millennia. There's no kind of novel introductions here. So this is a way, I suggest, a new way of thinking about an argument for the existence of God in terms of the overall shape and loveliness and fit of a theory. No long beard needed. Plato's beard, we can cut off Plato's beard without cutting our faces with Occam's razor. We found a middle way. That is an abductive argument for the existence of God. And notice, when I talk about a theoretical, the simplicity at the foundational layer, naturalist explanations of the modal, the mathematical, and so on, they've got all sorts of clever, for each of them, but don't get me wrong, they've got they're working really hard to come up with a good account of each of these 7 or 8 M words. But they're different accounts. The theist has just one account, one framework, one being. That's it. For each of them. It's lean and mean. It's elegant. It's lovely. I think it's an exciting argument, and I think it needs to be developed further. And I'd love to hear what you think about it. That's it. Matthew.
Might be a possibility of a ninth M as well, and I'm sure there are many others.
Oh, yes, please.
And I'm thinking of something like Bill Alston's M beliefs or manifestation beliefs.
J.L. Austin?
Bill Alston.
Oh, Bill
William
Alston.
Austin's.
From Alston.
Yeah. So this is the idea that people have these really deep experiences of God speaking to them, and they have a certain level of incorrigibility, so no matter what kind of deflationary explanations may be given about this is something that was going on with your brain or something, they're just unable to not believe that they were real experiences. And certainly for the theist, this isn't a problem. So I guess I was just wondering if you think, I mean, certainly I don't think Professor Price would admit this as a ninth M, but it does seem to me to be on a par as some of these other ones. For instance, moral truths, there are also deflationary explanations, just those stories that you mentioned from evolutionary moral psychology or game theory. And it's not true that everybody accepts kind of what we would take to be very fundamental moral truths. We think some people can be mistaken about moral truths that there are. There are many philosophers who say, oh, moral truths are just response-dependent properties, and so we can't say that it was wrong for Hitler to kill the Jews. It was actually wrong if Hitler didn't kill the Jews, because that would create a sentiment of disapprobation. I guess I'm starting to ramble a little bit. But my question is, just what do you make of, it really seems like these M beliefs really shouldn't be any more troubling than any of these others.
On your first point, William Alston, just to, by way of background, is one of the great philosophers of religion in the 20th century, second half of the 20th century. He was an atheist until he was well into his 40s. Converted to Christianity, very controversially. It's a controversial thing to do in the guild of Anglo-American philosophy. And he did so partly because he underwent a series of profoundly mystical experiences, which he couldn't explain with the naturalistic paradigm that he'd been brought up with. He wrote an extraordinary book for Cambridge University Press called Perceiving God in 1996, in which he examines this with extraordinary care and analytic rigor. It's a wonderful book. It's a difficult read, but it's wonderful to see this philosopher wrestling with something that is just eludes, is always at the edges of what he can really grasp philosophically. I think you're right, Matthew. I think mysticism, mystical experiences, are universally attested, diachronically, so they're happening all over the world. They've been happening for as long as there's been throughout recorded history. So we need an explanation, and the naturalist needs to give a naturalistically adequate explanation. I suspect that I might, on reflection, fold the mystical into the mental. And so these are broad categories, but when I was talking about whether Mary learns something new, this is perceptual, but I think maybe I could fold mystical experiences into the mental, in the sense that the naturalist has work to do. If the naturalist can come up with a thorough, and you've worked more on this than I have, If the naturalist can come up with a naturalistically respectable account of the mind and mental properties, then my guess is they'd say mystical experiences are no problem. That's just, it's kind of consciousness gone a bit wrong or something like that. Second part of your question, I'm so sorry, I've been a long day. Remind me a couple of words. Oh, was that? Okay, fine. You went to, it was a, yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yes, on the moral. Yeah. Okay. Right. Just to address that quickly, that was a distinct point. Yes, absolutely. There are moral nihilists. Error theory is possible. Hitler is possible. There have been Hitlers. There have been, you know. The moral realist, the claim that there really are moral truths, is not a claim that we all get those truths. We don't. And of course, it's a central part of the Christian story that, you know, we're almost constitutively deficient in being able to grasp those. So it's not, this is a question of ontology, that is to say, just what there is in the world, you know, all this, as opposed to whether moral agents actually properly connect to the world. And clearly they don't. But, yeah. The other thing to say is that some moral nihilists, or those who just reject the moral domain at all, in contemporary philosophy, do so partly, or at least sometimes chiefly, because of its inconsistency with naturalism. Right? So we have to shave that away because we can't have that in naturalism. So and that really is a strong motivating factor for rejecting moral truths as something that exists independently of us. Yeah. Thanks. Ben.
Thanks. I'd like to talk about the godlessness of the gaps thing you were talking about.
Got a copyright on that, by the way.
Okay. I liked it. I thought it was good. even when you acknowledge that there is like a, I don't know if that's the right word, but like spiritual and natural, if there is something in addition to the natural world, how do you go about defining what the natural world is able to explain and what's not? Like, where do you draw those lines? Because otherwise, you're going to continue going on that path and you're never going to reach an end to it.
Thank you.
Is there a solution to that?
Just got back from Oxford, where I work, and we had a faculty meeting yesterday. And after it, four professors spoke for 15 minutes each on what nature is, what the natural is. Fascinating. We had a Christian professor, Hindu, you know, from all the different corners of faith traditions. And it turns out that no one's really sure. If God exists, he has a nature. He does things that are consistent with his nature, that are natural to him. If he doesn't exist, he doesn't have a nature, and that doesn't fit within what's natural. If the number two exists, it is what it is. It has a kind of an essence, a nature. This is the old sense of the word essence and nature. There's a wonderful essay on the shifting use of the word natura and nature in medieval and Renaissance and early modern English and Latin by C.S. Lewis in a book called Studies in Words, where he shows just how much it changes. But I can't go into it now, but I'll just a brief synopsis. Someone living before 1600, roughly, would just not have understood what you meant if you said, that's supernatural. It just would not have been intelligible. It certainly wouldn't have could have made any sense of the idea that God is supernatural. It was not a category. Nor, I think, is it a category in Greek or Roman thought, as far as I can think. As far as I can tell. In Greek thought, you've got nature versus phusis, nature versus nomos, convention, what society decides. So there's the natural world and there's the sort of civilized world. That's an opposition that is definitely there, a contrast. But they didn't have the category of the supernatural. And Christianity, Judaism, and Islam definitely doesn't have it, and here's why. I said earlier about how monotheism naturalizes the world, kind of evacuates it of the supernatural. Because within the monotheistic traditions, there's the creator, God, and everything else. There's the creator, and there's everything that's created. There's everything that's God, and everything that's distinct from God. That's it. So they couldn't make sense of something within the created world. There's this natural bit, and there's this supernatural bit. There's this bit that floats above creator. What does that mean? Now, of course, supernatural becomes sort of byword for anything that is not within the natural sciences. So effectively, the natural now stems from, my guess is, mid-19th century here in Cambridge, when science is getting going. William Whewell, Master of Trinity, first to coin the word scientist. The moral sciences are happening, the scientiae, the bodies of wisdom that investigate morality. And suddenly they realize, oh, hold on, there's this other thing that we're doing which isn't that. Well, let's call that the natural sciences, because that's about nature, not about morals and so on. So you have the moral sciences and the natural sciences. And then very quickly, the natural sciences just become the sciences. But encoded into that is this notion of nature. This is nature is what sciences do. And everything that science doesn't do is supernatural and spooky. So they kind of won the linguistic, they've won the semantic battle on that front. Long answer, but yeah. Any other thoughts? I'm amazed at your endurance, I really am.
I don't really know what it's like to be a naturalist or a non-theist. Except probably on a bad day, but I think I've always been a Christian. And when you're communicating with other people, as you know, it's important to know how it feels and to know their perspective, mm-hmm. both in their arguments, but also in sort of what it's like to read the paper of a theist when you're not a theist.
Yeah.
And so I'm hearing you say, well, you're interacting with them on sort of methodological naturalism, but what do you do, and what's it like for you to try to understand the naturalist that you're interacting with?
I was one. Till I was 25. Basically, to the extent that I thought about it at all. Which was not much, so that doesn't really... Well, here's what I do. I use all of the tools in their toolbox. The criteria for loveliness, the problem, Hugh Price's M words. Hugh Price is the best atheist, the most sophisticated atheist I can think of, certainly in this country, one of the most brilliant man. He says naturalism's got these problems. I'm not inventing. I'm taking their problems. I'm taking their tools. I'm not introducing spooky Platonic realms. What else can I do? I'm trying to do everything with what they're struggling with, and I'm trying to use the tools that they're using. I'm not bringing in the Bible. I'm not bringing in Aquinas. I'm not appealing to the creeds. Everything is on there. This is purely philosophical. I haven't invoked any of that. I'm starting from where they start from. Starting with the problems they start with, and I'm trying to use the tools that they think are legitimate. Tools, legitimate hallmarks of what good philosophical conclusions and theories should look like. What more can I do? Andrew.
Could you do some speculation for me? Naturalism just can't solve the M-word problems. They just get to the end. They can't solve it. They're not going to become theists. So where are they going to go? What's after naturalism?
Yeah, great question. I gave a paper in the Divinity Faculty this afternoon that started from a recent, very interesting argument for why you need to ditch naturalism if you want to make sense of morality. This is in the leading philosophy journal in analytic philosophy. It came out 2 years ago. Started from there. So I wouldn't say it's a majority now, but there's definitely a growing minority report that just naturalism doesn't deliver the explanatory goods. It's not up to the job. It's had a long time. What's happened is that the debates in all of those different M-word departments have got more and more sophisticated, increasingly technical, increasingly fragmented, more and more PhDs, more and more monographs from CUP and OUP. I'm just culture. I have some colleagues in the Oxford philosophy faculty who say, this is great, look how rich and elaborate philosophy is getting now. Look how much funding we're getting for these. And I think naturalism is basically a research project that is failing. And I just think it's failing. There is a kind of non-naturalistic but non-theistic kind of halfway point that's very unstable, very, very... it's very, very sort of tricky halfway house, but not impossible. What you're getting, though, is complexity, theoretical complexity. Plato's beard is getting longer. The shaving kit is left where it is. And some of them know that there are theological frameworks that, one theological framework that could really do a lot of this, but then they're not going to touch it. And that, then you can just say, look, that's just prejudice, that's not philosophy. I have actually come across very sophisticated philosophers who run an argument that you might call reductio ad theologiam. You might have heard of the reductio ad absurdum. The idea there is you're not sure where an argument goes wrong, but once you get to the conclusion, it's so bonkers that you know it's gone wrong somewhere. And it's so bonkers that you don't need to show where. Because look where it takes you. I have very bright, sophisticated philosophical colleagues who run the reductio ad theologiam. The thought here is any philosophical conclusion that ends up with God in the conclusion, ends up with God in it. We don't need to tell you where the argument's gone wrong, but look, if the price to be paid for solving that M word is theism, just steer clear of that M word. And I'm happy for the conversation to stop there. There's a point in all philosophical conversations, I believe, where Wittgenstein says, "I turn my spade, I can do no other." That's true whether you're doing theistic philosophy or atheistic philosophy. There comes a point where argument stops. You say, "These are my intuitions. These are what I think. These are the true conclusions these are what I take to be true. And I believe these things more than I believe the premises of any argument to the contrary." These are so-called... G.E. Moore, another great Cambridge philosopher, came up with one of the shortest and most beautiful arguments in analytic philosophy. It goes like this. Here is my hand. Here is my other hand. Therefore, the external world exists. What's going on there? Well, a little bit of history, a little bit of background. Up until that point, since the 1650s, really, since Descartes' skepticism, doubting everything, doubt. If you want to get to certainty, you've just got to pretend that everything is in doubt. And the one thing that you can't be in doubt about is the process that's a condition of the possibility of you doubting, i.e. thinking. So at least we're thinking. Even if I'm being constantly deceived, the evil demon needs thoughts to get his teeth into to deceive me. So at least I think. Je pense, non, j'existe. I think, therefore, I am. There is this bedrock certainty. So this is the starting point, just skepticism. G.E. Moore says, that's mad. I'm not going to spend my philosophical career trying to worry about whether I really have got hands. I mean, that might be a philosophical problem, but why should it be mine? Why should I bear the burden of proof? It's the skeptic, it's the person who's telling me I don't have hands that needs to do the work. And whatever work he does, no argument he can advance, the premises of no argument he could advance are going to be more certain to me than the conviction that these are my hands. I think it's an exciting time to be a philosopher. I think it's an exciting time in particular to be a theistic philosopher. Because we're getting to the point where the naturalistic paradigm is really creaking. It's not, I don't want to over-egg this, it's not like, but there are serious structural internal tensions and contradictions that I feebly, but others far better than I am, are exploiting and sort of unraveling. And sometimes that's happening from within. And Matthew talked about William Bill Alston. I mean, that's what happened with him. He just said, look, this paradigm is just not working anymore. Some of you might have heard of Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, 1962. So this is this guy who says, you might have heard the term paradigm shift. He says, this is how scientific progress works. It's not through discovering new things. It's just like we get a kind of gestalt switch. So we went from Newtonian physics to Einstein. And what that required just a complete leap, an imaginative leap into something completely different way of thinking about things. And what Kuhn says is that before the paradigm shift comes, often what you get is an increasing flurry of epicycles of technicality. Lots and lots and lots of theories, a supernova of theories. And people often think this is a good thing. This is a sign that our discipline, our research project is in good shape. My colleagues in the philosophy faculty, it's great, just look at all the funding, look at all these different, look at all these PhDs coming through, and you know, we're nearly there. We're going to have 40 PhDs on that M word next year, and you know, we're going to make progress here. Actually, I think it's quite the reverse. I think it's a sign of a research project in trouble when it starts splintering like that. I think it's a sign, how can you be certain? I think it's a, you can look at the sociology of knowledge, the development, discovery of new paradigms that just work way better than the old ones. What happens before the new paradigm comes is this kind of creaking and this splintering effect. And I think it's a sign of a theory of a research project in trouble, and I think naturalism is a research project. And I think it's in trouble, and I think that's a sign that it is. Yeah.
That's all the time we have for this evening, but if you want to stick around later on, I think James offered to talk with you. Thanks for coming this evening. Next week we have Nature and Grace, the work of films of Terrence Malick, who's the director of New World, A Thin Red Line, Tree of Life. And then finally, the UK release date has been updated for May 7th, I think, his latest film, Night of Cups, which is coming. But we have a lecturer next week who's a bit of a Terrence Malick.
Also,
expert.
Badlands, 1975, and Days of Heaven.
Excellent.
For those, you might, it's great.
And then in 2 months' time, we have Arthur here giving a lecture on Charles Taylor's Secular Age, Religion for Charles Taylor's Secular Age. So please come for that, but that'll be after Easter in a couple of months' time. So let's, again, give thanks to James for coming this evening.